Welcome to Gima's Tales for Children. Each week we visit a different part of the world to hear stories, legends, and myths. Some of these stories are so old that the origin has been lost in time. Some are new, and some are timeless. Join us this week and for the next few episodes as we hear stories about the holidays. This first episode is all about holidays for the harvest and, of course, Thanksgiving. While the Thanksgiving holiday is primarily part of our American heritage, there are many stories throughout Europe about Thanksgiving. Harvests were essential for survival during the long, cold winters. Corn and wheat were important staples, and many stories have been written about their origin. For further information about the Thanksgiving holiday for children, I suggest www.momjunction.com/articles/Thanksgiving stories for kids. Our first tale is an Iroquois legend about how corn first came to the world. Here is The Spirit of the Corn. There was a time, says the Iroquois grandmother, when it was not needful to plant the corn seed, nor to hoe the fields, for the corn sprang up of itself and filled the broad meadows. Its stalks grew strong and tall and were covered with leaves like waving banners and filled with ears of pearly grain wrapped in silken green husks. In those days, Onata, the spirit of the corn, walked upon the earth. The sun lovingly touched her dusky face with the blush of the morning, and her eyes grew soft as the gleam of the stars on dark streams. Her night-black hair was spread before the breeze like a wind-driven cloud. As she walked through the fields, the corn, the Indian maize, sprang up of itself from the earth and filled the air with its fringed tassels and whispering leaves. With Onata walked her two sisters, the spirits of the squash and the bean. As they passed by, squash vines and bean plants grew from the corn hills. One day, Onata wandered away alone in search of early dew. Then the evil one of the earth, Hagwadega, followed swiftly after her. He grasped her by the hair and dragged her beneath the ground down to his gloomy cave. Then, sending out his fire-breathing monsters, he blighted Onata's grain. And when her sisters, the spirits of the squash and the bean, saw the flame monsters raging through the fields, they flew far away in terror. As for poor Onata, she lay a trembling captive in the dark prison cave of the evil one. She mourned the blight of her cornfields and sorrowed over her runaway sisters. "Oh, warm, bright sun," she cried, "if I may walk once more upon the earth, never again will I leave my corn." And the little birds of the air heard her cry, and winging their way upward, they carried her vow and gave it to the sun as he wandered through the blue heavens. The sun, who loved Onata, sent out many searching beams of light. They pierced through the damp earth, and entering the prison cave, guided her back again to her fields. And ever after that she watched her fields alone, for no more did her sisters, the spirits of the squash and bean, watch with her. If her fields thirsted, no longer could she seek the early dew. If the flame monsters burned her corn, she could not search the skies for cooling winds. And when the great rain fell and injured her harvest, her voice grew so faint that the friendly sun could not hear it. But ever Onata tenderly watched her fields, and the little birds of the air flocked to her service. They followed her through the rows of corn and made war on the tiny enemies that gnawed at the roots of the grain. And at harvest time, the grateful Onata scattered the first gathered corn over her broad lands, and the little birds, fluttering and singing, joyfully partook of the feast spread for them on the meadow ground. The next story is the classic story of the Pilgrims' first Thanksgiving, but it includes a little more history than we usually hear, and an interesting fact about the first child born at that time. Here is The First Thanksgiving. Nearly 400 years ago, a great many of the people in England were very unhappy because their king would not let them pray to God as they liked. The king said they must use the same prayers that he did, and if they would not do this, they were often thrown into prison or perhaps driven away from home. And so they left their homes and went first to Holland. It was about this time that they began to call themselves pilgrims. In Holland, the pilgrims were quiet and happy for a while, but they were very poor, and when the children began to grow up, They were not like English children, but talked Dutch, like the little ones of Holland. The children started to change their views from those of their parents, who had been born in England. "This will never do," said the Pilgrim fathers and mothers, so after much talking and thinking and writing, they made up their minds to come to the New World, America. They hired two vessels called the Mayflower and the Speedwell to take them across the sea, but the Speedwell was not a strong ship, and the captain had to take her home again before she had gone very far. The Mayflower went back too. Part of the Speedwell's passengers were given to her, and then she started alone across the great ocean. There were 100 people on board. They were very crowded. It was cold and uncomfortable. The sea was rough and pitched the Mayflower about, and they were 2 months sailing over the water. In the middle of the Atlantic, the first baby was born, and they called him Oceanus for his birthplace. It is sad to note that Oceanus died when he was only 7 years old, but one of his brothers went on to grow to a very ripe old age. His name was Stephen Hopkins, and he lived into his 80s and was the oldest person to sign the Declaration of Independence. At last, the Mayflower came in sight of land. It was a cold November, and there was nothing to be seen but rocks and sand and hard, bare ground. Some of the Pilgrim Fathers, with Captain Miles Standish at their head, went on shore to explore. They were the first Europeans to meet the first people who lived here. They called them Indians. The Indians were frightened and ran away, so the Pilgrims stayed near shore and decided to settle near a place with fields for planting and plenty of clear running water. Then, at last, all the tired Pilgrims landed from the ship on a spot now called Plymouth Rock, and the first house was begun on Christmas Day. The weather was cold, the snow fell fast and thick, the wind was icy, and the Pilgrim Fathers had no one to help them cut down the trees and build their houses. The Pilgrim Mothers helped all they could, but they were tired with the long journey, and cold and hungry too, for no one had the right kind of food to eat, nor even enough of it. So first one was taken sick, and then another, till half of them were in bed at the same time. Captain Miles Standish and the other soldiers nursed them as well as they knew how, but before spring came, half of the people died. But by and by, the sun shone more brightly, the snow melted, the leaves began to grow, and sweet spring had come again. Some friendly Indians had visited the Pilgrims during the winter, and Captain Miles Standish, with several of his men, had returned the visit. One of the kind Indians was called Squanto, and he came to stay with the Pilgrims and showed them how to plant their corn and their peas and wheat and barley. When the summer came and the days were long and bright, the Pilgrim children were very happy, and they thought Plymouth a lovely place indeed. All kinds of beautiful wildflowers grew at their doors. There were hundreds of birds and butterflies, and the great pine woods were always cool and shady when the sun was too bright. When it was autumn, the fathers gathered the barley and wheat and corn that they had planted, and found that it had grown so well that they would have quite enough for the long winter that was coming. "Then," said the Pilgrim Mothers, "let us have a great Thanksgiving party and invite the Indians and all rejoice together." So they had the first Thanksgiving party, and a grand one it was. 4 men went out shooting one whole day and brought back so many wild ducks and geese and great wild turkeys that there was enough for almost a week. There was deer meat also, of course, for there were plenty of fine deer in the forest. Then the Pilgrim Mothers made the corn and wheat into bread and cakes, and they had fish and clams from the sea. The Indians all came with their chief, Massasoit. Everyone came that was invited, and more, I dare say, for there were 90 of them all together. They brought 5 deer with them that they gave to the Pilgrims, and they must have liked the party very much, for they stayed 3 days. They were dressed in deer skins, and some of them had the furry coat of a wildcat hanging on their arms. Their long black hair fell loose on their shoulders and was trimmed with feathers or foxtails. They had their faces painted in all kinds of ways, some with black stripes as broad as your finger all up and down them. But whatever they wore, it was their very best, and they had put it on for the Thanksgiving party. The Indians sang and danced in the evenings, and every day they ran races and played all kinds of games with the children. Then sometimes the Pilgrims with their guns and the Indians with their bows and arrows would see who could shoot farthest and best, so they were glad and merry and thankful for 3 whole days. The Pilgrim mothers and fathers had been sick and sad many times since they landed from the Mayflower. They had worked very hard, often had not had enough to eat and were mournful indeed when their friends died and left them. But now they tried to forget this, and so they were all happy together at the first Thanksgiving party. All this happened nearly 400 years ago, and ever since that time, Thanksgiving has been kept in our country. Every year, our fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers have rejoiced together like the pilgrims and have had something to be thankful for each time. Every year, the story is told of the brave pilgrims and the kind Indians and how the first colony was settled so many years ago near Plymouth Rock. The next story is a very short one, which was written by the Brothers Grimm. Here is The Ears of Wheat. Ages upon ages ago, says the German grandmother, when angels used to wander on earth, the ground was more fruitful than it is now. Then the stalks of wheat bore not 50 or 60-fold, but 4 times 500-fold. Then the wheat ears grew from the bottom to the top of the stalk. But the men of the earth forgot that this blessing came from God, and they became idle and selfish. One day, a woman went through a wheat field, and her little child, who accompanied her, fell into a puddle and soiled her frock. The mother tore off a handful of the wheat ears and cleaned the child's dress with them. And then an angel passed by and saw her. Wrathfully he spoke, "Wasteful woman, no longer shall the wheat stalks produce ears. You mortals are not worthy of the gift of heaven." Some peasants who were gathering wheat in the fields heard this, and falling on their knees prayed and entreated the angel to leave the wheat alone, not only on their account, but for the sake of the little birds, who otherwise must perish of hunger. The angel pitied their distress and granted a part of the prayer, and from that day to this, the ears of wheat have grown as they do now. Next, we travel to Europe to hear about a Thanksgiving during the Middle Ages. Here is The King's Thanksgiving. Every child in the village was very much excited on account of the news that had come down from the castle on the hill. Because it had been such a rich harvest, the fields yellow with grain and the orchards crimson with fruit, the king was going to keep a Thanksgiving day. He was going to ask some child from the village to come up the hill to the castle and eat dinner with the prince and princess. It was rumored, too, that this child would be given good gifts by the king. But it must be a very special kind of child indeed. That they all knew. Then the village children remembered everything that had been told them by their mothers and their grandmothers and their great-grandmothers about the castle kitchen. Scores of cooks and scullery boys were kept busy there night and day. The fires always glowed to roast the rich fowls that turned on the spits. The cake bowls and the soup pots were never empty. Spices and herbs from far countries, strawberries when the ground was covered with snow, ices of all the rainbow colors, and cream so thick that a knife could cut it. All these were to be found in the king's kitchen. There were dishes of gold and silver upon which to serve the fine foods, and a hothouse of rare flowers with which to deck the table, and linen as fine as a cobweb, and as beautiful in pattern as snowflakes to cover it. Oh, a Thanksgiving day in the castle would be very wonderful indeed, the children thought, and each hoped that he or she would be chosen to go. The day before this day of Thanksgiving, the messenger of the king came down from the castle and went from door to door of the homes in the village. He went first to the house of the burgomaster. It was a very pretentious house with tall pillars in front, and it stood on a wide street. It seemed likely that the burgomaster's child might be chosen to go with the messenger to the castle for the Thanksgiving. She was dressed in silk, and her hair was curled, and the burgomaster had packed a great hamper with sweets as an offering for the king. "Are you ready to keep the feast as the king would like you to?" asked the messenger. "Oh, yes," said the burgomaster's child. "I have on my best dress, and here are plenty of sweets to eat. Will you take me?" But the messenger shook his head, for the child was not ready. Then the king's messenger went on until he came to the house where the captain of the guards lived. The captain's little boy was quite sure that he would be chosen to go with the messenger to the castle for the Thanksgiving. He wore a uniform with silver braid and buttons, like that which the guards wore. A sword hung at his side, and he wore a soldier's cap. He held the cap in his hand so that he could put it on quickly. "Are you ready to keep the Thanksgiving Day as the king would like you to?" asked the messenger. "Oh, yes," said the child of the captain of the guards. "I have my sword here, and I can fight anyone who crosses our path on the way to the castle. Will you take me?" But the messenger went on again, and he came to the baker's shop. The baker's boy stood at the door, dressed in his best white suit and holding an empty basket on his arm. He was quite sure that he would be chosen to go to the palace, for his father's bake shop was an important place in the village. They measured their flour carefully and weighed the loaves so that they might receive the utmost penny for each. They very seldom had any crumbs left for the poor, but they were selling a great deal of bread every day. "Are you ready to keep the Thanksgiving Day as the king would like you to?" the messenger asked of the baker's boy. "Oh, yes," the boy said. "I have this basket to gather up whatever remains of the king's feast and bring it home with me. The king would not want anything wasted. Will you take me?" But the messenger shook his head a third time, for the child was not ready. Then he did not know which way to go, and he began to think that he would not be able to find any guests for the king's feast. As he waited, he saw two children, a girl and a boy, coming toward him. They were poor children, and one was leading the other, for he was lame. The messenger looked at them. The little girl had eyes like stars, and her hair, blowing in the November wind, was like a cloud made golden by the sunset. She held her head so high and smiled so bravely that no one would have noticed her old dress and the holes in her coat. The messenger stood in the road in front of her and spoke to her. "Are you ready to keep the Thanksgiving Day as the king would like you to?" he asked. The little girl looked up at the messenger's face in surprise. No, I'm not ready," she said. "But this child is. I am bringing him because he's lame and because he's hungry. Will you take him?" she asked. "Yes," said the messenger, "and you too. There is room at the king's table for both." This last story takes us back to the Iroquois and their legend about the fall months, a bear and the stars. It is called The Hunting of the Great Bear. There were four hunters who were brothers. No hunters were as good as they at following a trail. They never gave up once they began tracking their quarry. One day, an urgent message came to the village of the four hunters. A great bear, one so large and powerful that many thought it must be some kind of monster, had appeared. The people of the village whose hunting grounds the monster had invaded were afraid. The children no longer went out to play in the woods. The long houses of the village were guarded each night by men with weapons who stood by the entrance. Each morning, when the people went outside, they found the huge tracks of the bear in the midst of their village. They knew that soon it would become even more bold. Picking up their spears and calling to their small dog, the four hunters set forth for that village, which was not far away. On a great pine tree, they found the scars where the great bear had reared up on hind legs and made deep scratches to mark its territory. The tallest of the brothers tried to reach the highest of the scratch marks with the tip of his spear. "It is as the people feared," the first brother said. "This one we are to hunt is Nyagwaye, a monster bear." "But what about the magic that the Nyagwaye has?" said the second brother. The first brother shook his head. "That magic will do it no good if we find its track." "That's so," said the third brother. "I have always heard that from the old people, those creatures can only chase a hunter who has not yet found its trail. When you find the track of the Nyagwaye and began to chase it, then it must run from you." "Brothers," said the fourth hunter, who was the fattest and laziest, "did we bring along enough food to eat? It may take a long time to catch this big bear. I'm feeling hungry." Before long, the four hunters and their small dog reached the village. It was a sad sight to see. There was no fire burning in the center of the village, and the doors of all the long houses were closed. Grim men stood on guard with clubs and spears, and there was no game hung from the racks or skins stretched for tanning. The people looked hungry. The elder sachem of the village came out, and the tallest of the four hunters spoke to him. "Uncle," the hunter said, "we have come to help you get rid of the monster."
"I am not sure you can do that, nephews," the elder sachem said. "Though we find tracks closer and closer to the doors of our lodges each morning, Whenever we try to follow those tracks, they disappear. The second hunter knelt down and patted the head of their small dog.
Uncle, he said, that is because they do not have a dog such as ours. He pointed to the two black circles above the eyes of the small dog. Four eyes can see any tracks, even those many days old.
May Creator's protection be with you, said the elder Sachem.
Do not worry, Uncle, said the third hunter. Once we are on a trail, we never stop following until we've finished our hunt.
That's why I think we should have something to eat first, said the fourth hunter. But his brothers did not listen. They nodded to the elder Sachem and began to leave.
Sighing, the fattest and laziest of the brothers lifted up his long spear and trudged after them. They walked, following their little dog.
Brothers, the fattest and laziest hunter complained, don't you think we should rest? We've been walking a long time.
But his brothers paid no attention to him. Though they could see no tracks, they could feel the presence of the Nyagwae. They knew that if they did not soon find its trail, it would make its way behind them. Then they would be the hunted ones. The fattest and laziest brother took out his pemmican pouch. At least he could eat while they walked along. He opened the pouch and shook out the food he had prepared so carefully by pounding together strips of meat and berries with maple sugar and then drying them in the sun. But instead of pemmican, pale squirming things fell out into his hands. The magic of the Nyagwae had changed the food into worms. Meanwhile, like a pale giant shadow, the Nyagwae was moving through the trees close to the hunters. Its mouth was open as it watched them, and its huge teeth shone. Its eyes flashed red. Soon it would be behind them and on their trail. Just then, though, the little dog lifted his head and yelped.
Eh, eh,
the first brother called.
Four Eyes has found the trail, shouted the second brother. We have the track of the Nyagwae, said the third brother.
Fear filled the heart of the great bear for the first time, and it began to run. As it broke from the cover of the pines, the four hunters saw it, a gigantic white shape, so pale as to appear almost naked. With loud hunting cries, they began to run after it. The great bear's strides were long, and it ran more swiftly than a deer. The four hunters and their little dog were swift also, though, and they did not fall behind. The trail led through the swamps and the thickets. It was easy to read, for the bear pushed everything aside as it ran, even knocking down big trees. On and on they ran, over hills and through valleys. They came to the slope of a mountain and followed the trail higher and higher, every now and then catching a glimpse of their quarry over the next rise. Now, though, the lazy hunter was getting tired of running. He pretended to fall and twist his ankle.
Brothers, he called, I have sprained my ankle. You must carry me.
So his three brothers did as he asked, two of them carrying him by turns, while the third hunter carried his spear. They ran more slowly now because of their heavy load, but they were not falling any further behind. The day had turned now into night, yet they could still see the white shape of the great bear ahead of them. They were at the top of the mountain now, and the ground beneath them was very dark as they ran across it. The bear was tiring, but so were they. It was not easy to carry their fat and lazy brother. The little dog, Four Eyes, was close behind the great bear, nipping at its tail as it ran.
Brothers, said the fattest and laziest one, put me down now. I think my leg has gotten better.
The brothers did as he asked. Fresh and rested, the fattest and laziest one grabbed his spear and dashed ahead of the others. Just as the great bear turned to bite at the little dog, the fattest and laziest brother leveled his spear and thrust it into the heart of the great Nyagwae. The monster bear fell dead. By the time the other brothers caught up, the fattest and laziest hunter had already built a fire and was cutting up the big bear.
Come on, brothers, he said. Let's eat. All this running has made me hungry.
So they cooked the meat of the great bear. They ate until even the fattest and laziest one was satisfied and leaned back in contentment. Just then, though, the first hunter looked down at his feet.
Brothers, he exclaimed, look below us.
The four hunters looked down. Below them were thousands of small, sparkling lights in the darkness, which they realized was all around them.
We aren't on a mountaintop at all, said the third brother. We are up in the sky.
And it was so.
The great bear had indeed been magical. Its feet had taken it high above the earth as it tried to escape the four hunters. However, their determination not to give up the chase had carried them up that strange trail. Just then their little dog yipped twice. "The great bear," said the second hunter. "Look!" The hunters looked. There, where they had piled the bones of their feast, the great bear was coming back to life and rising to its feet. As they watched, it began to run again, the small dog close on its heels. "Follow me," shouted the first brother. Grabbing up their spears, the four hunters again began to chase the great bear across the skies. So it was, the old people say, and so it still is. Each autumn, the hunters chase the great bear across the skies and kill it. Then, as they cut up for their meal, the blood falls down from the heavens and colors the leaves of the maple trees scarlet. They cook the bear, and the fat dripping from their fires turns the grass white. If you look carefully into the skies, as the seasons change, you can read the story. The great bear is the square shape some call the bowl of the Big Dipper. The hunters and their small dog, which you can just barely see, are close behind the dipper's handle. When the autumn comes and that constellation turns upside down, the old people say, "Ah, the lazy hunter has killed the bear." But as the moons pass and the sky moves once more towards spring, the bear slowly rises back on its feet and the chase begins again. So we've come to the end of our time together today. If you have a story you'd like to hear, please feel free to write me with your request. If you've written a children's story and would like to share it, let me know as well. I welcome your feedback. You can email me at guima@kciw.org. That's guima@kciw.org. See you next week. Same time, same place, but very different stories. We'll travel around the world to hear more stories for the holidays that are celebrated throughout the fall months. Stories from Israel, the Middle East, and Asia. This is Guima saying goodbye and happy reading.